Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts. A ruthless leader consumed with power, a sinister plot, a secret CIA operative dreams of wealth and internet fame culminating in a brazen attack. No, that is not the elevator pitch for a new streaming series. It happened in real life. On February 13th, 2017, Kim Jong-un's half-brother and thorn in his side, Kim Jong-nam, was murdered in a bizarre attack in broad daylight at Malaysia's Kuala Lumpur International Airport. As details emerged, the story became even weirder and tragic. The assassins were two young women, barely out of their teens, who had never met. They are seen on CCTV footage as they approach the round, middle-aged Jong-nam from behind, and they quickly smear the world's deadliest chemical on his face and around his eyes. They quickly get away from the scene and go wash their hands. He died in about an hour. Were they cold-blooded killers, crazed cult members, or themselves victims of some sort of larger plot? And even in the bigger pictures, were they victims of exploitation? Assassins, the latest documentary from director Ryan White, who also directed the Emmy-nominated docuseries The Keepers on Netflix, examines this incident and forces that drove two young naive women to commit this heinous act and the dramatic trial that followed. It opens in select theaters and virtual cinemas on Friday and will be on demand January 15th. Ryan White joins me now. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you, Allison, for having me.
So this news story, it was big for just a couple of days, and then it sort of went away, oddly. When did you first hear of it, sort of the news headline of it, and then when did you learn about sort of the very deeper, darker layers?
Yeah, so in your recap, you mentioned that the assassination happened in February of 2017. So if you go and look back at that historically, that was a few weeks after Trump was inaugurated. So I think, like most Americans, for me, this was sort of a headline that I definitely saw. And I remember the detail of two female assassins. But very quickly, I think because there wasn't the real estate on air or in print, because Trump was dominating everything, this dissipated into the ether for American audiences. So I was no different than that. And then in late 2017, you mentioned my series, The Keepers, had come out on Netflix that year. A journalist who had seen that series reached out to me, and he was covering this story for GQ magazine. And he had done a deep dive into the life of Siti Aisyah, who was the Indonesian, one of the two female assassins and an Indonesian citizen. And he had done an investigative piece into what led her to this moment where she assassinated Kim Jong-nam at the airport. And his story was presenting this theory that she was admitting that she had assassinated Kim Jong-nam, but that she was claiming that she thought she was on a reality show when she did it and that she was tricked into doing it. And so, of course, the premise was literally unbelievable to me. But as we often do in our jobs, a few weeks later, I was so compelled. I was on a flight to Malaysia with this journalist, Doug Bot Clark. And that's when the film began. And we began following their murder trial where they were on death row for the last 2 years.
Let's give people a little bit of context for this. Who was Kim Jong-nam as relates to Kim Jong-un?
Yeah, so Kim Jong-nam was the oldest brother of Kim Jong-il, so many people considered him the rightful heir to the throne.
Oldest son, you mean?
They were, yes. Okay. And they were raised by separate mothers. So Kim Jong-nam and Kim Jong-un did not know one another. And so for various reasons we explore in the film, Kim Jong-nam was passed up for the leadership role. Mm-hmm. He was living in exile in Macau. And his younger brother obviously inherited the throne. But Kim Jong-nam was always going to be a threat to Kim Jong-un. And in fact, vocally, he was a threat even after Kim Jong-un took power, questioning hereditary succession in North Korea, making various comments that he hopes the people of North Korea can one day live a better life. So as long as Kim Jong-nam was around, he was always going to be a threat to his brother, to the point where there are reports that this was not the first assassination attempt on Kim Jong-nam's life. And Kim Jong-nam had actually sent a letter to Kim Jong-un begging for his life. So many people kind of think his days were numbered that led up to this moment in the Kuala Lumpur airport.
My guest is director Ryan White. We're talking about his new film, The Assassins. So let's talk about the two women who were the assassins. They're very young women, as I mentioned. You mentioned Siti. And so tell us a little bit about her. How about Doan? How would you describe Doan?
So Doan is from Vietnam. You know, the two women have very different backgrounds, but they're both from small villages in different parts of Asia. Siti left school in sixth grade and ended up in the sweatshop world of Jakarta and then the sex work world of Kuala Lumpur. Doan's trajectory is very different. She was quite educated. She had gone to college. However, she wasn't using her degree. She'd spent the last 5 or 6 years desperately seeking fame in Hanoi. So she was on Vietnam Idol. She was an actress on viral prank shows in Vietnam. She was doing a lot of modeling. So she was really gearing her life all around how to become famous, whereas Siti Aisha, who was a single mother living in Kuala Lumpur, was always seeking a better life and a better paycheck to send money back home to Indonesia. So the women claim that they did not know one another, that literally the moment they met is when they touched Kim Jong-nam's face at the airport. They came from different directions. But, you know, our film tracks their entire history leading up to that exact moment where they rubbed a chemical weapon on his face.
So this is a very well thought out, clever, very long game plan, although fairly lo-fi, you know, as it goes. And there were eight other operatives involved in all of this. So I'm curious, what, after going through all of this, what was it about these two women that convinced these operatives that they would be the right assailants?
Well, we know that they weren't the only women that were being conditioned for this. So, you know, the women, you know, I always see this as a very sort of universal story in that type of way. And I think, you know, when we go back to the headline that came out in February of 2017, it was very easy to otherize these women in the type of way, you know, they were being portrayed as these sort of Bond women, femme fatales, who must have been working for the North Korean regime. And when you get to know who they are and what led them to this moment, I think it's a very universal story in that type of way. I see it as a cautionary tale in a lot of ways about social media and the internet. And for whatever reason, these are the two women that made it long enough into this supposed reality show that they are the ones that ended up assassinating Kim Jong-nam. But they were by no means the only women who'd been reached out to by these North Korean operatives who were leading these women to believe that they were Japanese YouTube producers. So if you believe Siti Aisha and Doan Thi Huong, and we trace these paths in our film, they actually had been on a reality show for months leading up to this assassination. And we have a lot of these pranks on video where they were playing these sort of peekaboo type pranks with people all over Southeast Asia. And if you believe them, their final prank was a political assassination unbeknownst to them, but that they had been doing the exact same prank for months leading up to it.
Yeah, there's a very chilling moment when they're getting direction, they're getting feedback on their pranking skills, and I can't remember which one of the women it was, is directed to, you know, make sure you get your hands closer to the eyes, clearly setting the stage for an absorption of this chemical into the victim, just making sure that she knew what she was supposed to do, if you believe them, that she didn't even really realize it. She really thought she was just doing a prank. I think there's something interesting that's a little bit of a bigger picture, and you touched on a little bit in your last answer, but I wanted to draw it out a little bit, that there's sort of a bigger picture story you're telling or you're revealing about what young women who come to Kuala Lumpur and about the exploitation of these women and how it is possible. When did you realize that was going to be part of this film?
Well, I think naturally as a documentary filmmaker, I'm a skeptic. So even when I began making this film, it felt inconceivable that this would be a real defense for an assassination. So, you know, this wasn't a moment where I became completely aware these women might be innocent. This was sort of a slow burn for me. Mm-hmm. And that involved, because my two main characters were on death row, they were in solitary confinement of a Malaysian jail. I did not have access to them. But what I did have access to was their families from their villages where they grew up, and especially to their defense teams. And I think both had separate criminal defense attorneys, but I think both of those legal teams recognized that the truth of how their clients got to this moment was not coming out in the Malaysian trial. You know, the Malaysian police and the Malaysian prosecution seemed out to convict these women from the very beginning. And so there was this idea that if the truth wasn't going to come out in the courtroom, that the lawyers wanted to give us as documentary filmmakers, they wanted to arm us with all of the information that could defend their clients in hopes that the truth could come out in a documentary. And so it's when they started handing over all of this stuff to us. You know, you mentioned the text messages that we have in the documentary. It's also all of the CCTV footage from the airport, which is thousands of hours of footage that we had to piece together following the two women, following the North Korean operatives on the day of the assassination, and in fact, in the days leading up to the assassination when they were planning it. And the more we had access to all of that evidence, the more I started to realize these women might in fact be telling the truth. And then it became all the more important and heavy to make this documentary, because everybody on the ground was saying these women are going to be convicted and they're going to be executed. So we were actually preparing to release our film the moment they were convicted, in hopes that it might sort of spark some international outcry that they might actually be innocent. And I don't want to ruin the film for your listeners, but yeah, go on.
I say we won't give anything away. Go ahead, Ryan.
I'm trying to be very careful not to ruin the ending, but thankfully that didn't happen in the end, and there's some total shocks and surprises on what happens in this trial at the end. But that's kind of, we were preparing to sort of make, you know, to have a film with the world's saddest and most depressing ending, unfortunately.
I'm speaking with director Ryan White about his new documentary, Assassins. It'll be in theaters and virtual cinemas on December 11th and available on premium video on January 15th, video on demand, that is, of course. We'll continue our conversation after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. My guest is Ryan White, director of the film The Assassins, about the two young women who, whether they meant to or not, ended up killing the half-brother of Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-nam. So there's something so interesting. There's lots of interesting things, Ryan, about this. Everything, as you said, was recorded on CCTV. We see it. We see the moments before. We see the moments after. I think there's something there's this idea that North Korea is likely sending a signal here to do this so in such open daylight, in an airport, clearly it's going to be caught on camera. Why is it significant that it was done so much so out in the open?
Yeah, that's the real question, isn't it? Because most, you know, I've made true crime stories before, and most of the central thrust of most true crime stories is a whodunit. And that was sort of off the table at the beginning of this story because the two women were admitting it was them, and you can see it on camera. So the big central question is why? Why commit a public assassination in such a brazen international spectacle of a way, you know? And the North Korean MO before this had mostly, when it came to assassinations, had mostly been quite quiet, you know, dark alleyway sort of assassination. So the question is, why was this one orchestrated in such a public way? And I think Most people speculate that Kim Jong-un, if he orchestrated this murder, and it's almost certain that he did based on the North Korean operatives that certainly played a role, wanted to send a signal not only to his brother and you know, publicly humiliate him in this assassination, but also to send a shiver down the spine of all of his enemies around the world. And, you know, by doing this, he proved that he can pull off an assassination on international soil, all over camera, and get away with it. And so, in fact, it did have a chilling effect on the rest of the world. And so in that way, you know, people wonder whether he did it more for the fear factor.
There's so many different, I mean, there's geopolitics involved here because it involves North Korea, Malaysia. China also played a part to some extent. Let's play a clip from the assassins. Here's Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post, Anna Fifield, talking about the relationship between North Korea and China in regards to the Kim family.
Kim Jong-nam had been living in Macau for more than a decade. And there are a number of rumors that this was not the first attempt on his life, that Kim Jong-un had tried repeatedly to assassinate Kim Jong-nam. In fact, South Korean intelligence reported that Kim Jong-nam had actually written a letter to his brother saying, you know, please stop trying to kill me. Like, I am not a threat to you. You know, I do not want to be the leader. Please let me and my family, please let us live our lives. So he was extremely careful and conscious that he was always in danger. But because he was living in China, for North Korea to assassinate Kim Jong-nam, it's very difficult because, you know, North Korea is reliant on China. They are North Korea's number one benefactor, patron state. And from China's point of view, they had given Kim Jong-nam kind of exile protection, and in some ways were maybe keeping him in reserve, that if they wanted to replace Kim Jong-un, they could install Kim Jong-nam as the leader of North Korea.
That's from the film The Assassins. There's all this intrigue, geopolitical intrigue, and we learn, and I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, I think it's another element. We learn that Kim Jong-nam was a CIA informant. How did that information get out?
He was a CIA informant, and this wasn't his first meeting with the CIA, but in the days prior to his assassination, he had met with a CIA operative at an island in Malaysia, and was just passing through Kuala Lumpur on his flight home to Macau when he was assassinated. And we know the Malaysian government was tracking those meetings. We can assume North Korea was also aware that Kim Jong-nam was working with the American government. So many people wonder whether that final meeting is what led to the trigger being pulled, so to speak. You know, when Kim Jong-nam was found, his body, he had $138,000 of cash on him, which was presumably some sort of exchange for that meeting. Mm-hmm. And his laptop had recently had information downloaded from it onto a thumb drive. And so we don't know what that information was, but, you know, to that clip that you just played, his connections to China, you know, North Korea's greatest ally, and his connections to the U.S., so the two most powerful countries in the world, he was going to be a consistent threat to his younger brother. And then, you know, when we found out that he was giving information to the American government, that might have been the moment where he took it too far, finally.
My guest is Ryan White, director of the film The Assassins. So the Malaysian authorities knew there were eight others that were involved in some way. Why did they decide to focus on these two young women, Siti and Doan?
Well, in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, which we track in the film, the North Korean operative left the country immediately after Kim Jong-nam dies. So from the moment the VX nerve agent enters his eyes, he's dead within an hour. The women, if you believe them, didn't even know that someone had died. So they went back into the city of Kuala Lumpur and carried on with their days. the North Korean operatives, you can watch all over camera in the CCTV, go into bathrooms, change their clothes, meet with North Korean embassy officials, because North Korea has an embassy in Kuala Lumpur, and get passports and tickets, and they fly home to North Korea. So they escaped and were never going to be brought to justice in the immediate aftermath of the assassination. But these women were left behind. And so your guess is as good as mine on why Malaysia was so aggressive in prosecuting these mm-hmm. women. But most people presume it's because this was such a public embarrassment to Malaysia, that such a huge political figure had been assassinated on their soil, that to let everyone get away with it would have looked horrible, would have been egg on the face of Malaysia. And therefore, they felt like they had to hold somebody accountable. And since the North Korean operatives were already home, the only people who could be brought to justice were the women. So in many ways, people see these two women as sort of sacrificial lambs, to just not let everyone get away with this assassination, to hold at least somebody accountable.
Each of these women had different defense teams. And I'm curious what you thought they did right, the defense teams. And were there any opportunities the defense teams missed?
Well, it's the British system of law there. So the prosecution goes first, and then the judge makes a ruling based on the prosecution's case. And it's not a jury system. So when the judge made his first ruling, it was clear that he believed that the women were guilty, that they were lying about this prank show defense. So we were all gearing up for the defense to go, knowing that the odds were stacked against them. So the defense never got to bring in their case because of the twists and turns that the trial mm-hmm. took. But what they were doing, you know, obviously going up against the North Korean regime is dangerous, especially when you live in a country that has diplomatic relations with North Korea. So there's a North Korean embassy right there, and those officials were present this whole time. And these two defense teams, and they're great criminal defense attorneys that these women got, seem to be the only people, you know, going in front of microphones, shouting from the rooftops for the last 2 years, saying North Korea orchestrated this crime. Mm-hmm. Malaysia seemed willing to completely ignore that, to sweep this under the rug. So I give those defense teams so much credit for having the bravery to be basically the only people who were speaking publicly about the truth of what happened for the last 2 years.
The name of the documentary is Assassins. It'll be in theaters and virtual cinemas on December 11th, and then available on premium video on demand on January 15th. I've been speaking with its director, Ryan White. Ryan, it was a fascinating movie. Thank you so much for joining us.